Bob Murphy Show, episode 132.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. My guest today is Scott Bayer, who is the founder of the Market Urbanism Report. So let me just tell you a little bit about Scott himself. He's an urban affairs journalist. He writes columns for Forbes, Governing Magazine, The Independent Institute, and HousingOnline.com, and gives regular speeches and media interviews. So market urbanism, let me just tell you what that is. It's the cross between free market policy and urban issues. The theory calls for private sector actions that create organic growth and voluntary exchange within cities rather than ones enforced by government bureaucracy. So we're going to have a lively discussion here. I think you'll enjoy it. Where basically we're using the framework of free market economic policies to talk about problems that plague big cities that, you know, wouldn't come up so much in the suburbs. And I think it's pretty interesting discussion if you've never heard these types of topics discussed before. So without further ado, here is my interview with Scott Bayer. Well, Scott, welcome to the Bob Murphy Show.
Thank you, Bob.
So I guess as by way of introduction, you want to just explain how you got into this market urban. Well, why don't you define what the term market urbanism means, and then how did you focus on that particular topic? Because I think for a lot of listeners, Jane Jacobs is the only person, you know, who's has such an interesting specialty. And she wasn't, as far as I remember, like libertarian-ish per se. But anyway, I'll stop and let you talk. Go ahead.
Sure. So market urbanism is the cross between free market policy and urban issues. And people don't generally put those two concepts together. So I want to define what market urbanism is a little bit more specifically. So I think on one hand, market urbanism is a philosophy and really a theory. And we're asking, how would cities function under a completely free market without the government? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's kind of like an ANCAP in hyper-capitalist and libertarian type philosophy, where we're effectively saying, if you didn't have what we traditionally think of as public services and cities were instead a combination of the thousands of different interactions between different private sector actors mixed with infrastructure and larger services that are also privately run, how would cities end up functioning? And so the reason I describe that as a theory and a philosophy is that that's not exactly the status quo around the world right now. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going to go to hardly any country and find a fully privately run city. And so market urbanism, besides just the theory, is also a set of pragmatic reforms that I think are much more likely to pass politically in cities. And so they're not necessarily full on ANCAP or libertarian, but they're kind of like pushing in that direction. And so the different sets of market urbanism reforms that I like to really focus on and that I think will apply to the modern political context in cities are having to do with housing and transportation and public administration.
Okay, great. So that's great. And there's tons of material we can cover here, obviously. But how did you, can you just give us a little bit of the, you know, autobiography of what, you know, were you an ANCAP or a libertarian first and then you got interested in cities or vice versa?
I'd say for me personally, I actually began more being interested in cities. Mm-hmm. I didn't have necessarily a hardline philosophy, like a political philosophy, but I spent a lot of my late teens and early 20s living in cities around the country and becoming really interested in different political issues and really like quality of life issues relating to cities. Like, why is housing so expensive in cities? Why is there so much homelessness? Why is there so much traffic congestion? things of that nature. And so I think I spent a pretty prolonged period, you know, really having these questions and trying to research and really understand the nature of these problems. And that's when I stumbled upon some ideas that you might say are market urbanism ideas. So I read Jane Jacobs, mm-hmm. as you mentioned earlier, and she had really insightful opinions about how, like, not having top-down planning, but having bottom-up mutual exchange capitalistic type interactions actually bring a lot of creativity and prosperity to cities. And so she was a very early influence. But then also there was a, you know, you were asking about the market urbanism concept and really what's the origin of it. There was previously a blog called marketurbanism.com, and that's really the first ever market urbanism type blog that came about. And their series of writers were very influential in my thinking during this research period and kind of brought me to the conclusion that a lot of the problems that exist in cities result from top-down planning mm-hmm. and government outcomes and not allowing the market to work. And so I created a spinoff organization called Market Urbanism Report that is designed to really further popularize the market urbanism idea and bring it more into the mainstream.
Okay, great. So yeah, like I say, there's a ton of topics here, and that's so yeah, it's funny because it wasn't until Jane Jacobs, because I had the book I did, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism. I think there were some issues in there, you know, having to do with stuff like zoning laws. And that's some stuff I cribbed from her that I had never even heard the idea before, because on paper it seems like, yeah, who could be against zoning laws? Like, you know, you don't want some store opening up next to your house or whatever. But she made the point that, well, no, it used to be in like New York City that people, like the ground floor was all the shops and whatever, and then the owners lived right above. And so the benefit of that was the kids would be playing the streets and the owners would be upstairs looking out and keeping an eye on everybody. So it minimized crime, whereas now in major cities, like at least New York and Chicago, I can't speak to other cities, but it's, you know, there's the district with all the, you know, the commercial district, and then that's a ghost town on weekends. And so right. If somebody wanted to break into an office or whatever, it'd be a lot easier because there's nobody around. There's no witnesses. So anyway, just right. little things like that had never even occurred to me. This is interesting that's like your whole area here. So I don't know, I'll leave it up to you. Like, are there topics you think that are good ones to start with to warm people up to thinking about this sort of thing?
Well, I think you hit on it right there. Uh-huh. Zoning is, quite frankly, probably the biggest
okay.
one. And so I think if you're trying to look at cities and figure out from a libertarian perspective or an ANCAP perspective or a market urbanist perspective, how should we be thinking about cities? The first thing that we should really be going after is something like zoning. Mm-hmm. And zoning, just to kind of like define it, is a form of regulation that polices how land can be used, the amount of people who can live on land. So in other words, the density, and also just the general layout of cities is very much affected by zoning. So if you were to look at a typical zoning map in the United States, a vast majority of it is probably going to be colored yellow. And so that is single family zoning, basically a house that needs to be surrounded by a yard and have a driveway. And it can't really be, in a lot of cases, there's no flexibility to that model. So that's how a city needs to be laid out. And then you'll have a section designated to hospitals and a section designated to retail and a section, you know, a certain amount of parking that needs to exist in every section and on every lot. And so it's kind of like zoning really micromanages from the top down the way that a city needs to function. And I think that, and so it's kind of offensive to me at a philosophical level. Mm-hmm. But then also when you look at the specifics of zoning, that's when it really gets bad. Like the very specific things it's doing in cities. So for example, as you were mentioning before, New York used to be a place of mixed uses, and parts of New York City still very much are, because they were built before zoning. So you can walk out of your apartment and have basically your entire daily needs able to be met within walking distance. Well, most of the United States cannot be built that way because they were built after zoning, after separated use zoning was introduced. Another big thing that zoning is really causing a big problem is the housing affordability issue. Mm-hmm. So going back to the single family zoning, you know, if you can only put, if you can only subdivide your city in a way that has large lots that each have their, have one home on them, that might not matter so much in a place of low demand. But when you're talking about places like Los Angeles or San Francisco, or Boston that have really high demand pressures, you know, things like single family zoning or really any form of restrictive zoning is really going to create a housing shortage in those types of places because there's so many people who want to live there because they're good jobs markets. But if you can only build a certain number of units on a per acre basis and it's very limited because of the zoning, then it's kind of like a way to guarantee that your city is going to have a housing shortage and have, you know, be really expensive.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, I don't know, well, probably is on your radar, but within, I don't know, the last 5 years or so at least, even a lot of progressives who normally would be gung-ho for government planning, they've sort of had, there's been a backlash against zoning laws in, you know, and I guess just because the rents have gotten so outrageous on the West Coast that even people at Vox and Slate or whatever recognize, wait a minute, if you restrict the supply, that might make the price higher.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It's become kind of a bipartisan issue. It's also it's a really politically complicated issue. So in the cities that have been, so in the cities that are most affected by zoning and by high housing prices, you are starting to see this sort of internal soul searching of basically saying, hey, we have this form of top-down government regulation. It often was written, it often had racism in its roots when it was first written. Like a lot of early deeds and zoning laws actually did have racialized language within them that were designed to exclude certain people. And so I think it's and then of course it's had the consequence of making housing more expensive as well. So I think it's led to a lot of soul searching within mm-hmm. Democratic and liberal progressive cities to say, hey, like maybe we need to question this idea and reform some of it. And so that's why if you were to look at the leading examples of zoning reform around the country, it actually is taking place in progressive areas. Minneapolis just passed a law last year that effectively outlawed single family zoning. So it said that you can build duplexes or triplexes by right all the way across the city, and land cannot just exclusively be zoned single family. And then California has brought together various progressive coalitions to try to pass a state housing a state law that would upzone much of the state. So yeah, I mean it's kind of like these hyper left wing people per se are actually the ones who are attacking zoning. And on the other hand, a lot of conservative Republicans are trying to defend the idea of exclusive zoning. So you're seeing a lot of rhetoric out of the White House right now and out of Carson's HUD administration that's effectively saying, well, Democrats are coming in and trying to ruin the suburbs by lifting the single family zoning. And then people who are libertarians are kind of in the middle. And we've always been saying that zoning is bad. And so at this point, we're identifying more with the left on this specific issue than we are on the right. So it has been one of those kind of interesting political dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it was Tyler Cowen. I hope I'm not misattributing it, but I think he was saying something. He was kind of ambivalent, at least the thing I saw. This is a few years ago, where he was saying something along the lines of, it's not obvious, like if you, let's, so he was saying something along the lines of, yeah, if they were going to introduce new zoning, is it like the libertarian position would clearly be to oppose it because that's interfering with existing property rights. Because it's not so clear if there's rules, regulations in place. And so people bought homes with the understanding that this is what the kind of neighborhood I was buying into. And then if they go ahead and get rid of the zoning laws and all of a sudden, you know, I wouldn't have paid as much for this house and it lowers my resale value. So it's not obvious. So it's kind of like the same thing like with taxi medallions. Have you done anything on cabs per se? Like, is that a good segue? Or
yeah, well, So I understand that would be the same argument. You know, people who buy taxi medallions pay a lot of money for the medallions.
Can you, just for the benefit of the listener who doesn't know exactly how that, so how do cities historically or traditionally, how do they regulate, like, oh, we can't just have a free market in taxis because otherwise we'd be buried in yellow cabs. So what do they do to regulate how many cabs are available in a big city?
Right. So pre-Uber, they used to have a very robust medallion system where basically the argument you just said that city transportation departments would not want their cities to be flooded with unlicensed and unregulated cabs that might cause traffic congestion. So they would issue medallions. And the issue always with those programs is they didn't issue enough medallions. And so there was a shortage of cabs based on the supply of the cabs compared to the actual demand in the consumer market for having cabs. And so they'd issue medallions, which were the license that enabled people to drive a cab. But because there was a shortage, they would sell for obscene amounts. I mean, like
hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? And like in New York City, I think they were over $100,000.
More than that.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
I've read about medallions being seven figures.
Oh, okay.
Because you'd have these secondary business people who would buy them up and then try to resell them and, you know, basically gouge the price. And so, yeah, you had this kind of crazy medallion system, and then Uber came along and was less regulated or had a different set of regulations and brought a lot of competition into the market. And so now a lot of those medallion owners are seeing the natural market price of their medallions drop dramatically compared to what they paid for them. And yeah, that's kind of caused a problem. But yeah, I guess I would look at that from the perspective of I'd rather see a natural market exist for that kind of service. And so while it's unfortunate from the cab driver's perspective, I think it's good from any form of deregulation generally is good for the consumer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't even remember. I'm pretty sure that it was Tyler who said the argument I just said, and I don't remember what his, you know, if you want to be, but I have heard, so this is not Tyler. I don't want to confuse listeners. I have heard other free market economists say, like with Uber and whatever, that they thought the government should buy out the cab drivers. In other words, like pay them the difference. And, you know, like, in other words, our new policy is causing a genuine economic harm to you in the sense that, you know, you're the market value of your thing dropped by $100,000. So what we'll just make you whole, you know, with the taxpayers will, and the idea being, so the argument was it's a move toward, it's an efficient move. The gains to the winners outweigh the losses to the losers. But instead of making cab drivers bear the brunt of the losses, why don't we just spread it across, you know, the community as a whole by having, you know, taxpayers cover it? So I'm guessing you would not endorse that. You would just say that's, you know, your tough luck for buying into the government cartel.
Well, I actually wrote an endorsement of that policy several years ago.
I did a lot of research before this interview. I knew that.
I wrote that article. I wrote an article saying something to that effect in Forbes several years ago. So that might have been what you had read.
Someone said it to me verbally, and it wasn't you. But
okay. Well, I mean, yeah, I think that's a fair argument. And what I was writing effectively was saying that if this sort of reimbursement could then increase the political support for broader taxi deregulation, I think that would be a path, because right now I think a lot of people who are against services like Uber and Lyft are looking at the cab drivers who have gotten royally screwed over by having the government effectively backtrack on their earlier policy. And this would effectively just be a way of saying, well, we're going to cover for your losses on this because we did backtrack, but now you have to go forward with the more liberalized rules, and it creates more of an equal playing field.
Yeah, I suppose some other purist economists might come along and say, well, no, I mean, a taxpayer who never takes cabs or Uber shouldn't be having to pay for it. Like, it should be like the people who take cabs and Ubers who pay, you know, for the new regime that they're benefiting from. Like, in other words, if you could more narrowly target who's paying, you know, because again, it's obviously an efficient move if if the gains of the winners outweigh the losses to the losers. But
yeah, but I, as far as that specific mindset goes towards zoning, I don't quite see it that way. I don't think it's quite an apples to apples comparison. I think with the situation with zoning, when people move into a neighborhood, sure, it might be zoned a certain way, but the rezoning of that neighborhood is not necessarily going to decrease their property values. I think if anything, if you're rezoning it for more intensive use, it will actually increase their property values. So if we're going to look at a very specific case, like the liberalization of what they call accessory dwelling units, which is an additional unit that you that can be built on somebody's single family property. If you were to have a zoning deregulation that allowed that, that would not decrease the value of the homeowner's property. That would actually increase the value just because they're able to further utilize their land.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah.
Okay. So I guess, good point. I'm glad you pushed back on that. I guess the argument would be something like, if I were going to keep my house the way it were, or maybe I'm in a neighborhood that has a homeowners association. So we in this neighborhood can't, you know, I can't even put up political signs or whatever. I certainly can't, you know, build a thing for a renter or whatever. So given that we're not going to alter our property, the fact that what used to be, you know, a little sleepy suburban town next to us now has a bunch of mid-rise apartment buildings, that makes our, and there's now more congestion and stuff like that. I try to go to the grocery store and I got to wait 6 minutes just to turn left or something. That makes it less appealing to live now in my house than it was before the change in zoning laws. I guess that would be the argument.
Well, so I have a couple of things. I mean, I think the main prescription, I guess, I would suggest for that is that I think there's a difference between private HOA style deeds and municipal city run zoning.
Right.
And so for people who want the stability, who want neighborhood stability, I think it's perfectly fine for them to go into a private HOA-run neighborhood that has a deed that will keep the land and the property a certain way. I would kind of view that as like that's a market urbanist alternative to zoning. Like the people who want stability and don't want change in their areas, they can go to the deed of their, to the deed of neighborhoods. But I don't really view government zoning as something that's like justifiable. I think it's a I think when you're talking about non-private neighborhoods that are run and serviced by the city, I think there should be more of an obligation that if you're going to move into such a place, it should be more open to the public, and that you shouldn't be having it should not be restrictively zoned. And I think that kind of defies the original purpose of what a city is. And so I view that as more of like a form of regulatory capture of trying to, you know, use regulations to hardwire your own financial interests or lifestyle interests at the exclusion of somebody else. Mm-hmm. And while it may be acceptable in a private neighborhood, I don't think it's acceptable in a city.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, with all this stuff, I'm just sort of playing devil's advocate and just, you know, letting you say things on stuff that like some of the listeners might be puzzled about. So let's see another one. I'm just curious because when I lived in New York for a while, when I went to NYU, like some of the rent controlled areas, I mean, I couldn't figure out like, how is it not just that some real estate developer comes in and pays the city council $1 million under the, like each person under the table or something. In other words, there was so much money lying on the table as it were, in order to get rid of the rent control, knock these buildings down and rebuild them. And I guess, is it just that the political opposition from like the community, the people politically representing the you know, the poorer or lower income tenants who would not be able to afford the new buildings and they would call it gentrification and stuff like that? Like, is that, in other words, economically, it was crazy that there was this prime real estate sitting there that could have easily, you know, had a lot of middle income people there and bustling businesses and stuff. And yet it was like a rundown area and it was because of zoning.
Yeah, well, I think rent control
rent
control sticks around is because, for one, it's very difficult to evict tenants a lot of times.
Sorry, I didn't finish. What I meant to say was, like, I would think they could go in and buy off every single person, too. That was the link in my argument I forgot about. In other words, like the gains to the winners were so much higher than the losses to the loser that I couldn't understand, like, you know, why doesn't Round Coast show up and say, guys, and have them pay off and like move them somewhere else or so. I guess because they would say, no, this, we grew up in this community. We want some rich person coming in. And I don't know. But have you ever, it just seems to me it's so crazy, some of these existing neighborhoods and why somebody doesn't come along and make it, grease the wheels of trade with just throwing money around.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think you would, in order for them to do that, in order for a developer to do that, they would have to buy off every single tenant. And so you're going to have holdouts because in order for a New York building to just be demolished and completely reconverted into market rate units, and if it is an existing rent control building, then every single tenant has to be out of that building in order for that conversion to happen.
Right. And then Mrs. Morrissey, who's been there since 1962, starts raising her price. And then then the developer has to go to the crime boss and be like, hey, can you take care of a little problem I got over here? And okay. Well, you're probably right that it's, and also just that the idea of that scheme, if a New York newspaper got a hold of that, that wouldn't look good. And that would, you know, there would be this, I guess that's partly why it wouldn't work, because it would just, people wouldn't like it, even though you could say there's literally not a single loser here. Everyone is being compensated and agrees to this, and they still wouldn't like it.
Right.
Just like with the congestion, like it astonishes me. You know, I would, so I commuted. My grandma lived in Long Island, and I would, for a certain period there at NYU, that's where I would come in, you know, on the train, sometimes I would drive, and it would take you forever, like hours, just to go in if you went, try to go on rush hour. So people going to work every single day. And I really think the homicide rate is higher because of that pot. Like, you know what I mean? Like, not on any given trip, but just the tension and the stress and whatever. In the long run, fewer people would be murdered in New York City if they had, you know, privately owned roads and market prices. But yet when I would try to explain that to people, like, this is crazy. Like, everyone complains about the traffic and everything. And I would say, well, yeah, right. So just privatize it, and they would charge tolls and let the, you know, and everyone's gonna be like, oh, no, the only rich people would, like, it's so insane to people that you would let a private business own the road and charge a market price for the traffic or the, you know, the toll.
Yeah. Well, I don't think if they were to do that, I don't think only rich people would drive. I think what would happen is, you know, when you have, so there, a lot of times there's like dynamic pricing. A lot of the best toll roads usually have dynamic pricing where the price of using it depends on the time of day and the level of congestion, and it's all indexed to that. And so, you know, I think in a lot of cases when you have dynamic pricing, people will, the rush, the peak hours, morning and evening, will have the highest prices. And so, yeah, maybe only the rich people will be able to use the road at that time. But it will also distribute demand across the day because, you know, 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. and midnight are not going to be as expensive. And so it has a way of like dispersing demand and having people who don't have to be making a trip right in the heart of rush hour to make it at a different time. And so I view it really as a way to increase the capacity and usage of the road without actually having to have congestion.
Oh, right. I totally agree. That's partly why I was telling the anecdote, was just I was so astonished that they thought that that'd be, you know, be like saying, well, no, I mean, if airlines were privately owned, only rich people would fly. Or, you know what I mean? Like, or if cars were privately produced and owned, then only rich people would own cars. Like, it's, you wouldn't use that argument anywhere. And yeah, like you're saying, we're having like 8 lanes of traffic or something, and that's all going to be guys in their top hats with their chauffeur. Like, that's crazy. Of course that, you know, it wouldn't just be rich people, like you say. And the other thing too, in case some of the listeners have never heard these arguments spelled out, let me just cover our bases. All the stuff so right now they do have dynamic pricing or, you know, congestion pricing, or I forget what the term they use is. But I mean, they have that right now in major cities where, yeah, the toll to go over the bridge or whatever is higher at certain areas of or certain times of day. And it's not enough. Like, in other words, what if they privatize it, presumably it would be higher to ease the flow. And that does all the stuff, like they have HOV lanes right now, high occupancy vehicle. Well, you wouldn't need that stuff. It would just, the market would take care of it. You know, that people would carpool and whatever to conserve.
HOV is in my opinion, not a very smart policy. Like that's kind of, I view that as kind of like a top-down government planning
policy.
Right,
exactly, yeah.
Where it's effectively saying, well, you need to have multiple people in the car to use this specific space. But I don't know. I mean, I think in a lot of cases, there aren't going to be multiple people in a car. It's kind of like trying to engineer a certain outcome that I don't think is destined necessarily to happen. So here's an alternative way that you get a lot of, that you might have a lot of ride sharing besides just having an HOV lane, is if you have market pricing. I actually do think that more people, so if you have HOV, I mean, if you have market-based pricing and you're having a bidding process for the use of the roads, I think in the peak situations where the prices are highest, you would likelier have private buses because it's sort of like 10 people using a bus are going to be able to outbid a single occupancy driver for the use of road space. So it's kind of like, I think in that situation, you would have exactly what the pro HOV people want to accomplish, but it would happen through a market-based situation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just to avoid confusion, I'm saying the existing system right now is so bad and it's like they've had to resort to peak pricing and or congestion pricing or peak load, whatever they call it, and things like the HOV lane. But you're right, the HOV lane's stupid because like if you were in a helicopter looking down, you would see during rush hour all the lanes crawling along and then this one lane that's moving decently, but yet there's not that many cars in it. So that's like they're taking one lane out of commission or, you know, making it at 75% capacity, which is the exact wrong thing to do if the problem is congestion. And so, yeah, you're right. If they just charged a market clearing price, that would automatically give people incentives and they would carpool and stuff because they go, holy cow, it's going to be $30 to use the bridge. Well, why don't we all, you know, we'll park over here and we'll all take Jim's car and we'll split it. You know, people would do that. But if you really needed to go somewhere and yourself, you'd suck it up and pay it. And you could because now all the traffic would be moving. So the point being, in case people are missing the punch, traffic jams are not a fact of nature or that's just driving for it. That's a shortage. There's the road is being underpriced. That's what a traffic jam is.
Right. I mean, yeah, it's the same thing with airlines. It's kind of like, why is it more expensive to fly the week before Christmas than the week after Christmas? Because that's when the most people are doing it. So this idea of like dynamic pricing and surge pricing, and some people even call it price gouging, although I view that as kind of like a pejorative phrase. But I mean, it's the same general principle. It's like the demand and the supply affect the price. And so when the demand goes up and the supply remains stagnant, the price is going to go up. But I mean, it also, that has the effect of distributing the demand across a longer time span and has a certain efficiency to it. And so I think that applies whether you're talking about planes or trains or Ubers, or in this case, the use of a road.
Folks, let's take a break from the discussion to explain why you should contribute to the Bob Murphy Show if you haven't yet already. I'm telling you guys, I got a lot of stuff that I want to cover, not just the interviews, great interviews I got lined up, but also some old school material talking about the roots of progressivism, postmodernism, all kinds of stuff that I think is important to understand what the heck is going on right now in U.S. Culture and politics. But, my time is limited. And so the more of you who donate, it just means the more time I can devote to the podcast because I'd love to be doing this and nothing else. But we're not quite there yet. I appreciate the contributions have really been flowing in. I appreciate that a lot. If you haven't yet done so and you're on the fence, go ahead, give it a whirl. Go to bobmurphyshow.com/contribute. Thanks, everybody.
Just to switch topics, I know you cover a lot of stuff. Do you get into like food vendors? Is that something you cover?
Yeah, a little bit. So that kind of goes back to a zoning thing.
Right.
And we were talking earlier about the way that zoning can be used as a form of regulatory capture. And I think it is 99% of the time used for precisely that. But there's a lot of zoning that prevents food carts from being able to open up on the streets. And like, you know, they'll basically have these sidewalk ordinances that prevent a food vendor from being able to operate, or that will very much limit how many food vendors can operate in a given neighborhood. And that's a restaurant lobby type thing.
Right.
You know, restaurants don't want the competition. And so they use zoning as a way to block it. And you look at, to go back to like the medallion system, you look at New York City, the ability to get a permit to operate in New York City as a food vendor is like obscenely expensive. And so that's why you kind of have this very corporate, you know, if you've, you probably know yourself since you're familiar with New York City, like the food cart street food scene is really not all that good in New York City compared to some other cities because the cost of licensure is so high. And so it's kind of like these corporate hot dog sellers that don't really bring much creativity into the process. Whereas a place like Portland, ironically enough, has been really liberalized on this front. And so they have like all these really interesting food cart vendors all over the city. And like you'll go to a given block and there will be dozens of vendors selling Indian food, Southern food, New Orleans food, like Chinese, yada, 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 everything under the sun. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of liberalization.
And also, like, for in terms of like to give a leg up to the, you know, the struggling poor person who's just really, you know, got a great work ethic or whatever, like that's, you're right. Like, that's the kind of thing, like, especially someone like, you know, who maybe doesn't speak the language well or, but they're a really good cook. And so this is an area, without too much startup capital, they can have a little food cart and set up a shop there on the corner and da da da. And that, but yeah, it's effectively impossible for them, for such a person to do it in like New York because it's so prohibitively expensive.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of market urbanism, a lot of the ideology, you know, for some reason, people who are critics of capitalism view capitalism as like, this is a paradigm that helps the big banks and the big developers and the big corporate millionaires. But I view capitalism and market urbanism specifically as something that is designed to reduce the barriers to entry. So it's actually, in a way, it's like anti-corporation and anti-big bank, and anti-big restaurant and anti-big developer. It's effectively saying if you loosen the regulations, more people can participate in the system and there will be more competition. And that, I think that goes for food carts. I mean, food cart would be probably the ultimate example of that.
Yep. So, and also too, with zoning, like, you know, one of the complaints is, oh, affordable housing. And so, oh, we need the government to have more subsidies and to build more. And no, it's because of the zoning. That's why housing is so unaffordable, you know, in these areas. It's undeniable, at least in the United States, I can't speak to other countries, that the big cities typically are totally run by Democrats, like, they're, you know, machine politics. And, and why, do you have a theory for why that is?
Yeah. Not really. I mean, I think a lot of it is innate in the sense that it seems like the more that people cluster, the more likely they are to be liberal. And that's generally been shown. A lot of demographers have demonstrated that the more spread out people are, the more likely they are to be conservative, and the more concentrated they are, the more likely they are to be liberal. And so I think the Democratic and Republican parties have kind of taken that strategy and that message accordingly. Like, it seems like the Republican Party is entirely branded towards rural America, and the Democratic Party is entirely branded towards urban America. The interesting thing is that this seems to cause them to get away from their principles in a lot of cases. Like, you know, kind of talking earlier about the whole conservative effort to say that rezonings are a form of socialism and they're trying to government engineering coming in and try to eradicate the suburbs. Well, that seems like a case where the party is getting away from its capitalist roots and it's just trying to appeal to low density rural and suburban voters. And I think it's kind of the same with Democrats in a lot of ways. It's like they'll get away from their ideas of maybe like of what liberalism was traditionally supposed to be, and they're just appealing to urban voters. And so it kind of has this weird way of separating and dividing America.
Yeah, I think that's true. So I hadn't thought about the concentration per se. What I was going to say is, and maybe this will be the last thing I'll ask you here because we're kind of hitting up on the time constraint. I could imagine somebody saying something like, yeah, I mean, I get markets are cool and everything. And, you know, you got to be careful about big government and the nanny state. But I mean, I would be okay if some dinky little town in Kansas wanted to try an experiment in low taxes and deregulation and, you know, let's get rid of zoning and let entrepreneurs do whatever they want. But like, are you kidding me? In Manhattan, with all those people crammed in there, we're just going to have anarchy? Like, doesn't that seem really risky? Like, don't you want to have central planning when it's the stakes are so high and there's so many people there? Like, I could see just that seems very intuitive and commonsensical that even to me, like even as I'm saying it, like I don't feel like I'm being unreasonable by thinking, whoa, that sounds like a dangerous experiment to introduce too much liberty where there's millions of people all crammed together. That seems kind of, let's not rock the boat.
Well, I would say that New York, I mean, I guess the different things I would say to that is that New York City was at some point not nearly as regulated as it is now. Mm-hmm. And it didn't completely collapse. I mean, basically, that's how a great modern industrial city was managed to be built,
right,
is
right.
because of the lack of regulation. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of the biggest problems that it has now, particularly regarding the homelessness and some of the school segregation and some of the high housing affordability issues, like to me, that's caused by the government. It's not caused by the market. And so I guess I don't really see much of a downside to just unleashing everything and letting the market work. But at the same time, I think to go back to an earlier divide that I was talking about, like a lot of market urbanism is not necessarily saying let's do all out libertarianism on a place like New York City. Let's work in a market direction. Like let's have policies that incrementally take us there. So that's not going to be throwing out the zoning map entirely, because that's not going to happen anyway. It's more like let's have rezonings and let's have a broader liberalization of the zoning code so that more can be built everywhere all across the city, you know, and not one neighborhood is really like having to take too much of the change.
Yeah. And by the way, I agree with you. Obviously, I was being somewhat tongue in cheek there. But yeah, I think you're right that these bustling cities developed in an area of relative laissez-faire. And that's why they're such big. And then they become so rich, because I think there's a lot of reasons economically with the division of labor and stuff, that economies of scale, you bring a lot of people and crunch them together. The productivity goes through the roof. And so like, you know, also you don't have much living space. So there's downsides, but it's sort of like the reason people coalesce there and coagulate the word. The reason they come together like that is because it's way more productive. You know, that like it's not, you know, you have people on the skyscraper with all the lawyers and engineers and, you know, everybody all within, you know, the same building and stuff. And so those big cities, they can afford the luxury of crazy, wasteful, you know, big government programs and, you know, liberalism in the modern political sense, that they can afford that overhead and that waste because they're otherwise so wealthy.
Well, yeah, there's an NYU economist named Alain Berteau, mm-hmm. who is very popular in the market urbanism movement, and he describes cities as labor markets. They are effectively just places that people go to work jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a vast majority of people go to cities for that reason.
Right.
Cities have always had the most jobs and the best jobs, and so that's why people move there. And then some of the recreational things kind of like spill over from that and create yet more jobs. But yeah, I mean, I look at it as like they're job markets, they're agglomeration economies, they're great centers of economic productivity, and they generate a lot of money. And so that ultimately becomes money that governments can go out and waste and further waste. But
and obviously in the U.S., like I think just about all the major brainstorm here have to do with like access to waterways and stuff. So clearly, you know, the reason the big cities are where they are historically was because of shipping and stuff like that. So clearly it was commercial. Yeah. And that's also incidentally one of the arguments about like the welfare states that like Bernie Sanders likes, that they got rich by having relative laissez-faire, and then they could afford their big generous welfare safety nets, and that and their growth slowed.
Yeah.
So when people point to, you know, the social democracies over in Scandinavia or whatever, and that proves socialism works, it's like, no, actually, it really doesn't. But in any event,
no, one comes before the other.
Yeah.
You know, like you got to have the growth and the capitalism to produce the money to create all those programs.
I said that was it, but let me give you a chance. How? Because I'm sure the readers now are on the edge of their seats. So why are there the homeless problem, and what would you do about it, Scott?
Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, I think, you know, not every homeless person is in the same situation.
Right.
There's some people who are severely mentally ill, you know, and they're always going to need government assistance, in my opinion. But I mean, I think a lot of the a lot of the homeless situation, a lot of the reason some people are homeless is not because necessarily even their own problems, but they are living in really expensive housing markets and they're either underemployed or they're not working, they're working jobs that don't pay them very well. And they're having trouble finding decent housing in their markets. And I think the main market urbanism answer is you got to really liberalize the market and allow and loosen zoning and allow a lot more housing construction, because that's going to make, that's going to suppress prices across the entire metro. And it's going to make developers more likely to build affordable starter homes that can be bought by the working class.
Okay. So you don't think it's so much a problem of homelessness as houselessness, if I could be somewhat, you know what I'm saying? Like, in other words, it's not that there's like an issue of lifestyle. It's more, there's no an economic issue and these people really just can't afford shelter.
Yeah, the lifestyle issue, that's kind of, I guess that's a tough one, because I think what you're saying there is that there may be some people who actually do want to live homeless.
Well, I mean, maybe want's not the right word, but in other words, I can imagine some people saying, no, it's not just, oh yeah, prices are high and they got put, like, whether some like cynical Scrooge person who's like, they choose to do that, or like left wing, like sort of social worker type, like, oh no, you're looking at this like it's a rational cost benefit, Scott. No, these people have, you know, genuine needs and they need us to come in and, you know, help them work on their emotional problems and they need to get, you know, proper treatment and that. So I realize you anticipated some of that, but.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think it's a combination. So I think there are people, there really are, you know, the places in the U.S. that are dealing the most with homelessness are the ones that have the high housing prices. Mm-hmm. Like, homelessness is actually decreasing across the country. It's increasing in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York. Mm-hmm. So I'm viewing this really above all as a housing affordability issue. And I think if housing were made more affordable, mm-hmm. there'd be a lot of people who are homeless now and working who would not be homeless if homes were affordable. Now, beyond that, yeah, there's a lot of situations of people who are dealing with alcohol issues and substance abuse and domestic abuse and mental illness. And so I think that's where the homelessness situation becomes a lot more complicated, mm-hmm. and people have very different opinions on, you know, what types of programs or whether there even needs to be programs to help them. And so I guess the homeless, the specific programs that I have come to like the most are what's called transitional housing, mm-hmm. where you have all these like different nonprofits, and a lot of them are religious oriented as well, that try to take people who are struggling with, like, say, substance abuse, and give them training on how to kick their habit and give them like life skills and job skills, mm-hmm. so that they can enter the workforce and become self-sufficient. And so I tend to like those more than just sort of like the giveaway programs.
Yeah. I mean, in your experience, like, I, again, not that I'm an expert by any stretch on this stuff, but to the limits that I looked at these things, I think it's safe to say that the private charities, especially the, you know, church-based ones, you know, they're there to make sure like people literally don't die in the street. You know, I mean, it's out of compassion, but they would view as a success if somebody gets rehabilitated and doesn't need them anymore. Whereas the government, it really is a function of the more people that they're serving, the bigger their budgets are and whatnot. So, you know, I'm sure the, you know, the individual person who goes to work there, you know, wants to help and whatever, but in terms of the institutional logic, the government agency wants there to be more people who need them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, some people call that the homeless industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things we're seeing there is there are programs like Housing First that effectively just say, if you just house people, they'll be off the street. And so they'll be taking, like, it might be a net win for the city in some ways, because you're not having to pay for the high price of policing and health issues of having people live homeless. So if you just put them in stable housing, that'll help with the problem a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I think the problem with a lot of Housing First programs is they don't really try to like rehabilitate anybody. Mm-hmm. They basically just say you can stay in a home, but you know, it's kind of like a Band-Aid solution that's not really addressing the problem of why they're homeless, why they need public assistance. And so that's why I said earlier that, like, I think the transitional housing models are much better than housing first at trying to turn people's lives around and get them off of whatever situation has caused them to be homeless and actually make them self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, I think from a libertarian, if you're looking at this from a conservative libertarian perspective, and you're kind of like innately skeptical of government programs, I think transitional housing, homeless housing, is a lot more effective and kind of better in a lot of ways than just housing first, which is more of a giveaway, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, great. We covered a lot of material. I think we can stop there as a good logical point. So besides your website, is there anywhere else you want me to point people who are interested in learning more?
Sure. I think we have a website, we got Twitter handles, Instagram handles, Facebook, but I think if you're going to look at what the heart of the market urbanism movement is and the best destination to get good conversation every day, go to the Market Urbanism Report Facebook group.
Mm-hmm.
And we have multiple posts per day and it's a really active conversation. It's about 10,000 people.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah. So folks, this is BobMurphyShow.com/132 and I'll put links to all this stuff. Well, Scott, thanks for your time. And I'm sure the folks got to learn a lot about market urbanism.
Thank you, Bob.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit BobMurphyShow.com.